Good morning.
Welcome to our legislative committee meeting. We will go ahead and call the meeting to order at 9:30, and we'll start with roll call, please.
On the roll for the legislative committee meeting of October 9th, 2019, Director Canepa.
Here.
Director Cutter. Director Joya.
Here.
Director Haggerty. Director Ju. Director Kim. Director Mitchoff.
Here.
Director Sparing. Director Wagon Connect. Committee Vice Chair Bowders.
Here.
Committee Chair Abe Koga.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Great, thank you. Let's start with the Pledge of Allegiance. If you could please stand. Great. And just want to thank everyone for being here. I hope folks are okay in your respective communities as we experience this unusual situation right now. Let's see, we'll go to public comment on non-agenda item matters. Are there any public comment cards?
No.
All right, we'll move on then to item 3, approval of the minutes of the May 22nd, 2019 meeting. Are there any changes or comments?
Second.
Motion by Member Mischoff, second by Member Canepa. Any other discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? I'm going to abstain because I was not here. And motion passes. We will move on to item 4, a recap of the 2019 legislative year. And we have Mr. Abbs. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Abe Koga and members of the committee. So the 2019 legislative year is almost over. The governor has until Sunday night to sign the bills that are on his desk. And actually, he has a lot of bills, from what I hear, that still haven't been signed yet. So he's going to be busy over the next couple days. We last met in late May, and a fair amount has happened since then, and so I'll go over a couple bills that I've done brief write-ups in the agenda write-up, and then we have our bill tracking list afterwards, and I can just call out a couple bills to briefly discuss. So at the meetings earlier this year, we had discussions on several occasions about a potential wine industry bill related to fermentation units. And at the beginning of the year, Senator McGuire had introduced a spot bill related to air district hearing boards, which we understood to be a vehicle to eventually be a wine industry fermentation bill after we had talked with Senator McGuire's staff. And over the course of the year, the bill moved through various committees, never was amended to be anything other than an air district hearing board bill. About the time of our last meeting, we had a meeting with Senator McGuire, the Wine Institute, Jack Broadbent was there on behalf of the district. We had several other APCOs from other air districts there. Talked with Senator McGuire about wine emission fermentation units. And as a result of that meeting that we had with him, the senator opted to not move forward with his bill for the remainder of the year, and so it still remains in its Assembly Natural Resources as a spot bill on air district hearing boards. But about 10 days before the end of session, without our knowledge, Assembly Member Aggie R. Curry introduced a gut and amend bill that originally was dealing with the state budget health care programs, and all of a sudden it was amended to be on wine industry fermentation units. Caught us by surprise, and it was similar to a gut and amend that was done last year at this time on wine industry fermentation units. So I went and met with Aggie R. Curry's staff, also worked with other air district advocates and talked with member at the time the bill was in the Senate Environmental Quality Committee. Needed to have a rule waiver from Senate rules to get to environmental quality. So over the course of about 10 days, we talked with a lot of Senate EQ staff and other Senate staff about our, sort of what we understood the current issues related to wine fermentation units were. And in the end, the bill did get a rule waiver to be heard in Senate Environmental Quality, but the bill was actually never called and heard in Senate Environmental Quality. And so now it's a two-year bill. It's able to be reheard again when the session starts in January in Senate Environmental Quality. And so we're assuming that it'll probably move forward at that time. Although the bill was not moved, there will be a joint legislative hearing on Halloween, October 31st, down in Lodi, and it'll be hosted by Senators McGuire, Dodd, Assemblymember Aguiar Curry. Those are elected officials from our region, and then there's a couple elected officials from the Southern California area. They'll be hosting this joint legislative committee. It's going to be a couple hours long. There'll be a few topics that'll be not really air quality related, but one of the panel discussions they're going to have is related to wine industry fermentation. And the air district panelist will be from Santa Barbara Air Pollution Control District. They were the original air district that developed the best available control technology for wine emission fermentation units. And other air districts, including our air district, will have people down there to monitor and answer questions as necessary. So this is just a hearing to sort of try to get on the same page in terms of what the current technology is, what the requirements are, at the state level and the federal level, and hopefully at the end of that we'll all be a little bit more on the same page on what's required and what our understanding is of the issue are.
Is the issue as a wine aficionado? Well, I don't know that I like a lot of wine, so that's make a disclaimer. Thank you, but. Is it particulate matter? What is the smell? I mean, what is the issue?
Dr.
fermentation?
Mitchell, actually, the wine industry would like to see their fermentation tanks exempt, actually, from rulemaking by the air districts. The fermentation processes where they actually, create the alcohol creates VOCs, volatile organic compounds. And so if they're large enough tanks, they can be fairly large in terms of their emissions. And I think the concern that the wine industry has raised is that the fermentation process somehow impacts the taste. Taste of the wine. That's actually what's something that they've... and so there's a lot of experience down in Santa Barbara where they've established a best available control technology for these large tanks. And they've actually gone through a whole process of testing them. They have not seen this impact. But nevertheless, this is, I think, is that a fair statement? VOCs off of these, that's how they. The VOCs, when combined with nitrous oxides, create ozone. And so the air districts and CARB, for that matter, have taken the approach that there's no industry that should be exempt from requirements in the state of California if any or all processes contribute to air pollution. So it seems that everybody needs to have their fair share. So
obviously the Wine Institute represents wineries, and I thought it was a financial issue more, but you're saying it's a quality issue.
According to them.
I'll be happy to volunteer to do some testing.
Well, actually, that's what they want to do. They want to do a series of taste tests. So we'll let you know that you're volunteering.
So that was the most controversial thing that happened to us at the end of session. It wasn't the most controversial thing to happen. So we had a couple other bills that we supported through the process. Senate Bill 44 by Senator Nancy Skinner. So this requires the Air Resources Board to develop strategies for reducing diesel particulate matter from the medium and heavy duty sector, and to update that strategy every 5 years to look at applications and engine technology where reductions could be made faster, look at applications where the technology hasn't quite caught up to the operational cycles, and sort of look at ways that we can reduce diesel particulate faster than currently through the truck and bus rule. So that was good to see that one pass. Also, SB 210 by Senator Leyva. From down south. So this established the heavy duty smog check program. So this will take a couple years to roll out, but basically the concept of it is that heavy duty diesel trucks should undergo a smog check like regular passenger vehicles do. And what we found, at least in the passenger vehicle sector, is that for the first 5, 6, 7 years, generally there's a little degradation in passenger vehicle engines, but once you get around that 8-year mark or beyond, you start seeing a lot of vehicles will fail smog and release a lot more NOx than they were originally designed, and so it's good to see this smog check bill passed, and hopefully we'll see some reductions in the future as the program's rolled out. So with that, we'll go to the bill discussion list, and I'll just call out a couple bills that are either the governor has signed or were stopped along the way. So AB 40 by Assembly Member Ting. This was a bill that we originally supported way back in the beginning of the year, and it dealt with the CVRP program, so the clean vehicle rebates, and we took a support position, but the bill was denied a committee hearing in Assembly Transportation even before we could write the letter, and so we never submitted the letter because the bill just kind of never actually got to committee. And then shortly before the end of session, Assembly Member Ting amended that bill to still be about the clean vehicle rebate program, but instead of looking at long-term strategies and proposed funding levels for the CVRP program, what it did instead was to declare that only vehicles from manufacturers that were participating with the state of California's clean vehicle program would be eligible for rebates. And so this kind of gets into the California versus Trump administration clean air waiver, electric vehicle programs, and so this is another aspect of that where the bill would prohibit manufacturers from having vehicles eligible for the program if they're not on board with California's clean vehicle standards. So we'll see how that goes once the session kicks up again. Moving down the list, AB 661 by Assembly Member McCarty. So this was a wildfire smoke emergency plan bill. It was specific to the Sacramento Metro AQMD, and it requires the Air District to develop a wildfire smoke emergency response plan. We talked about this at a couple of our meetings, and our opinion looking at the bill was that we didn't feel that you needed legislation to direct an air district to take public health measures like developing smoke response plans. And the board and various committees have heard presentations of our district describing what we've done over the past year, and we did it without having a bill telling us to do that. The bill does have the Air Resources Board as part of this, as part of Sac Metro's wildfire smoke program. The Air Resources Board has to do a survey of all the air districts in the state, what they're currently doing for wildfire smoke response, and develop best management practices and some ideas for other air districts to, you know, bring everyone up to the same level. And so I think as part of that process, you know, CARB is naturally going to be looking to our air district to see what we've done and you know, hopefully spur some ideas for our fellow air districts to follow. Okay. And we'll go on to, see, we talked about AB 1714. AB 1744 by Assemblymember Salas. That was another one we talked about in a committee meeting, and that was that would establish an emission reduction credit trading program for air toxics. We took an opposed position on that, and that bill didn't move. And so you know, we'll check in on it at the start of the session next year to see if there's any thoughts about trying to move that bill forward. SB 1 from Senator Adkins, you may have read some newspaper articles about that. So that bill would have frozen federal regulations related to Air Quality, Water Quality, Endangered Species Act, and I think some worker safety regulations as of January 19th, 2017. It's been 3 years almost, 2017. And so if the federal government decided to roll back some of those regulations, at least in California, we wouldn't accept those rollbacks. And it would be similar for us to SB 288 from about 15 years ago, which was passed during George W. Bush administration related to Federal Clean Air Act rollbacks. But in the end, the governor, although it went to the governor's desk, the governor vetoed it shortly after it arrived. And I believe he stated that it was a solution in search of a problem or something. He thought the existing California regulations that we had on the books and in our current number of lawsuits that we had filed against current rollbacks, you know, was sufficient enough without passing the bill. So that one is dead for now. SB 69 from Senator Wiener. That was the Ocean Resiliency Act of 2019. We talked about that in committee. So there was a lot of that bill that didn't apply to the Air District, but there was one section that we were interested in. That was the Voluntary Vessel Speed Reduction Program, which our district, the Santa Barbara District, and Ventura County Air Districts have all successfully used to not only reduce ocean-going vessel speeds coming into port, which reduces NOx pollution from those vessels, but also would cut down on the risk of whale strikes on the approach. And so as part of that voluntary vessel speed reduction program, the districts would offer a small incentive amount for ships to reduce their speed within a certain range of port. And it, when you look at the cost effectiveness of that in terms of dollars spent per tons of pollution reduced, it's actually very competitive. And so we were hoping that a program like that would be codified in the future and funded by the state, since right now most of that funding comes from the districts or from penalty money. But that bill didn't make it out of appropriations at the end, but it'll be eligible to continue on next year. And so I'm anticipating that Senator Wiener will probably make some changes to the bill, maybe try to reduce some of the costs a bit, and then continue to try to move that forward. SB 216 from Senator Galgiani, that bill would have made changes to the Carl Moyer program and allow a what's called a trade down program. And so you would you would have one person who would want to trade in their old vehicle for a new vehicle. And instead of scrapping that person's old vehicle, he would find someone with an older vehicle and give his or her vehicle to that person that had the older vehicle, and they would scrap the older vehicle. These programs are really hard to administer because you have to find, you know, it's basically a three-party transaction, and you have to find a person with a really old vehicle that is, you know, going to accept a slightly newer vehicle, you know, with the understanding that vehicle is going to meet the exact needs that they use their older vehicle for. And so they're difficult to administer. It ended up not getting through its final committee. It was held up in suspense due to the costs associated with developing the guidelines, but it'll be eligible to be moved forward next year. SB 400 from Senator Umberg was signed by the governor. So this one affects us because it would allow the Clean Cars for All program, it would allow eligible projects to include e-bikes and e-bike subscriptions. And so currently our Clean Cars for All program is a Clipper card or a newer used vehicle. But this would, if the district was interested, we would be able to expand that to, you know, some sort of e-bike. And I think that is so that's it for the bills to call out from that list. A lot of them that haven't been signed by the governor will be eligible to continue on next year. Some of them will probably be amended to become other bills, but once the legislative session starts in January at our next meeting, I'll have an update of where we stand then.
Great, thank you. Are there any other questions or comments on this item? Any public comment? No? All right, thank you. We'll move on then to item 5 regarding Assembly Bill 836. This is
Mr. Okay, Alex. So Assembly Bill 836 was signed by the governor. So actually signed while the board was considering the West Oakland Emission Reduction Plan. I got a call from Assembly Member Wicks' staff that the governor had just signed the bill. So that was good news. And we had as you can see on this list of supporting organizations, we had a pretty good list of groups that had joined in support of the bill, from public health organizations, fellow air districts, even some cities and counties that joined in, and so overall it was a good effort. We didn't get a single no vote the entire way, so it was truly bipartisan, and we're hoping that we can arrange to have Assembly Member Wicks come to a future board meeting to receive some recognition for carrying that bill for us. And so we've put in that request, and hopefully we'll be able to make that happen. So going forward, what this means is, so the governor is in the process of working on the 2021 budget. And so since this bill is now in law, it'll be Department of Finance will you know, take a look at the bill, the costs associated with it, see if it's something that can be if it's a priority to be worked into the 2021 budget, and then for our part, you know, we need to try to make sure that happens by talking with the Department of Finance, the governor's staff, and Senate and Assembly staff to make sure that it's a priority for someone that we can keep moving that forward, and so that's one of the one of the tracks we have to try to get this funded moving forward, and there's some other things we can do that I have to discuss in the next agenda item.
Alan, I see that the League of California Cities is endorsed this, but not the California State Association of Counties. When you reached out to them, did they just say they wanted to stay neutral, or Was there a problem? Because I see, you know, County of San Diego is here, so a lot of times CSEC likes to stay away from stuff that might be one end of the state likes it, but another end doesn't. But did you? I'm just curious what feedback you got.
So I talked. There were a couple organizations I talked to, and you know, talked about the bill, asked for their support, and sometimes, you know, they're really excited to do so, and sometimes they, you know, it's just not the highest priority for them, and so it's not to say that they were against it, but it was just, you know, didn't rise to the top level.
Any other questions or comments on this item?
If I can, Madam Chair, we have heard, I should say, Mr. Nutt could add to my remarks, but we have heard some interest by some of our community groups to, as we get funding in this bill, you'll notice that it explicitly calls out the vulnerable populations. So we're going to need to prioritize. What does that mean?
Right.
But I think some of our community folks that we work with are very interested in being able to hopefully see some of these clean air centers be first targeted in their communities.
Absolutely.
So. My understanding of the language of the bill is that they're trying to target the funding for communities that have chronic PM exposure, and so places like East Oakland would be a good, you know, candidate for immediate attention.
Great. I just wanted to mention, I didn't see on the list, but the Cities Association of Santa Clara County also supported the bill, and I'm sorry you didn't get that from us, but we did send in some letters to the legislators as well. And I just want to thank you and all of you for your hard work on this. It's not easy to get a bill passed, especially on the first shot, so this is really quite impressive.
And signed,
yes. So congratulations, and thank you for all of your leadership.
Thank you, and I'll add that, you know, obviously I couldn't have done it without staff from the district here,
yes,
including Tracy Lee and Patrick Wenzinger and the rest of Wayne Keno's staff, and so it truly was a group effort.
Yes, agreed. Thank you to all of you. All right, and no public comment on that item, so we'll move on to, was it item six, the 2020 legislative priorities.
Okay, so 2020 is going to be pretty busy, especially with an election coming up. So because there's an election coming up, it's the time when we start seeing bond ballot measures, and there's a couple that are going to be pretty noteworthy this year. So one of them you've probably read about is the education bond that was signed by the governor to go on the ballot. I believe that's going on the March ballot, I think. And so that bond is $15 billion. It's a pretty large bond. One of the things I noticed when I read into the bond language is, it's for new school construction, modernization, and a couple other categories. But under the modernization program, it does call out that eligible projects include ventilation systems at schools, and so, you know, there's a possibility that some schools could see some benefits if that bond passed that would be related to our clean air centers idea. So,
do they have to be public schools?
So my understanding of the bond is that it's public schools and then charter schools, you know, that are hosted under public school.
And I'm just asking, sort of thinking of some of our recent meetings and down in the South Bay area.
So that's one bond measure, and then there's also the split roll tax initiative is going through signature gathering right now. There was one, the first version of the split roll tax passed and was going to be on the fall ballot. But the proponents, I believe, pulled that initiative so that they could redo it with some wording that was more protective of small business. And so they're in the process of getting new signatures to qualify that for the fall ballot, but that would split the tax roll between residential and commercial. And so that if that passed, there might be some effects for the district in terms of the property tax collection that that we receive here at the district. So so those are the two of the bigger bonds or two of the bigger initiatives. And then there's also a series of climate change water bonds that are still in the works that could appear on the fall ballot. And we've talked about some of those in the past committee meetings, but there's three of them that are all sort of in the mix. One of them that we talked about before, SB 45, from Senator Allen in Southern California, and then about 2 weeks before the end of session, a new climate change water bond bill was amended from Assemblymember Eduardo Garcia, also in Southern California. And it's pretty similar to SB 44 in that it has about $4 billion for climate change, wildfire, and drought. And then both of those bills within their buckets of funding that would be available identify hydration centers, clean air centers, and cooling centers for funding under the climate change impacts in urban areas. And so what I anticipate is going to happen is these two bills will probably get merged into one bill or made into mirror images of each other. And they would have to go to the governor and be signed by early May in order to be put on the fall ballot for a vote. And so we've met with the staff for the assembly bill version recently, and they've kicked off a series of stakeholder work groups to get input from folks. To maybe subtract out some of the projects they have on the list, add some projects that aren't on the list, and so we're interacting with them to make sure that our clean air centers are in that final list, if it does go to a vote. So we're still working on that, and then there was a third bond bill, AB 1298, which is Assemblymember Mullen from South San Francisco, and that's a little bit different than those other two bond bills, because that one focuses a lot more on electrification, transportation, and so we'll be. I'm not sure how that one fits in with the other two bonds, whether that one would get merged in, or whether this is going to be a separate competing bond measure. But at some point, the voters may get tired of having so many bonds to vote on at one election, and so we'll have to figure that out as well. So those are the big items on the ballot. So getting on to the state budget, so Department of Finance and the Governor's Office, once he finishes his bill signing this weekend, then the budget cycle will kick off in earnest. That'll first go out to the public in January with the governor's January budget, but leading up to that, we obviously are going to want to make our thoughts known on AB 617 funding, on other grant funding that the district receives, on clean air centers, and so we'll be trying to talk with the Department of Finance about how we can fit in on all that. And as well as talking with our contacts in the Senate and the Assembly to make sure that they understand the Air District's needs in that regard as well. So when we talk about the AB 617 program, so the last 2 years there's been two pots of money for AB 617. There's the implementation portion, which has been $50 million. Over the last each year for the last 2 years, and then the incentive portion, which has been somewhere around $245 million per year for the last 2 years, and those amounts of money have covered the work that six air districts have done in 10 designated communities, and so. But the Air Resources Board is likely going to add some communities this fall to that list of 10. And so there's going to be a bit of a squeeze potentially in terms of funding going out to the current 10 communities as we start adding more communities to this list. And so as part of this, not only do we have to talk to our legislators about the work we're doing in West Oakland and Richmond, but to make sure that we're as much as possible that we're held steady in terms of the amount of funding that we receive to support those communities. That's going to be challenging because everyone always wants more money out of the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, it's pretty rare that you can actually bump up your budget from year to year in those programs. And so that's absolutely going to be a challenge this year. But what it speaks to is our need to continuously educate our legislators and let them know that what we're doing is valuable work.
We going to talk about potential legislation or?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Good. Okay.
So just briefly on, obviously there's also a lot going on at the federal level, as you've probably read in the papers about the clean vehicle standards, some rollbacks in the Federal Clean Air Act. And so I think at the same time, it's also important for us to make sure that at the federal level that our legislators are supporting the work that the Air District does. And as an example, the U.S. EPA sent the Air Resources Board a letter about 2 weeks ago that claimed the state and air districts had fallen flat over the last 40 years in regulating air quality in California. And shortly thereafter, we had a delegation of our congressional delegation from California wrote a letter in response, and Senator Feinstein then turned around and asked for an investigation of EPA on how they came up to this decision, which is good to see that our federal legislators have our back at least when things are going tough. And so we'll want to make sure that at the very least we communicate to them about the work that we're doing, and that's important for them to support us. On that note, there's a Senate bill that was introduced by Senator Merkley from Oregon, and it would actually establish a federal Clean Air Center program, which would provide funding to cities and counties or air districts to promote exactly what we've been working on. And so I'm not sure where the senator got the idea from, but we've been in contact with him, and we actually convinced, I believe Senator Feinstein has come on in support of that bill, and we've also offered to the senator that we would get some congressional members from California to support the bill when it got to that point as well. So I think things like that are important to continue to do.
So, Madam Chair, I'll just mention something that for the committee's understanding is that in anticipation of the ramp up that's occurred on a federal level, I've under my own signature authority was able to secure part of the resources that are used by the South Coast Air Quality Management District in terms of their federal lobbying efforts and legislative advocacy efforts. For a small contract, we actually were trying out this. And so for some of you, it might come as a surprise, but this organization has not engaged on a federal level. It just hasn't in the past. I know your organizations all probably have done this quite routinely, but we haven't in the past, and I think it's now time we start engaging on a federal level. And so so far, this lobbying firm, Mark Kadish and Associates, has done well for us. But it's clearly, I think we need to be able to expand this as we move forward. So we're going to go out with an RFP and be able to select a consultant in the future, in the near future. And I just wanted to mention that to you because that is a fairly new place for us as an organization. We just haven't done federal advocacy work. And indeed, Alan and I are going to be back next week as part of a National Association of Clean Air Agencies meeting. We're going to tack on some of that and meet some of our Bay Area delegate staff as they're back there to continue to answer their questions, make sure we're known, make sure that they understand that there's some things they can help us with, particularly on this point about the SIP calls, and that was in the news quite a bit lately. And so I want to mention this to you because this will be front of the Ledge Committee here in the next set of meetings.
What kind of outreach are you doing pre-RFP? In the sense of how do you publicize that we're doing an RFP when we go out?
Well, actually, what I'll likely do, Director Mitchoff, is start to identify potential organizations we want to have them bid on this as we move forward, including Mark Kadish that we've currently relying on. But there are other federal advocacy organizations that the South Coast uses. They actually use, I think, two or three different organizations, so we want to talk to them. But I know MTC does, and a variety of other organizations here have federal advocacy work, so I want to reach out to a lot of them, try to have them apply.
Thank you. I appreciate that, obviously, going through an RFP process. But a number of the counties utilize, you know, there may be synergies, if you will, sitting and doing a lot of water work. I work with a lot of federal advocates on that, and so just want to make sure that we are. I don't want to give you a list. I guess maybe what we should do is tell you who we'd like to make sure an RFP goes out to. But I know CSAC utilizes, John, remind me, I can see him, but I can't think of their names.
Oh, the federal folks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's I can see it. Waterman? Is it?
Yeah, Waterman. Yeah.
Waterman and Associates.
Okay.
They probably.
I've seen
letters
from them.
Yeah, and some counties utilize them, but
okay.
Just to make sure that they get that.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Okay.
We'll do our homework, and including reaching out to all of you as well, see if you all have some suggestions.
Okay, so on to potential bills for 2020. So I have three ideas that we're trying to flesh out right now, and then there's a fourth that I'll mention briefly that would be appropriate to mention on a day like today, power shut off. So the first idea would be related to indirect source authority or magnet source authority. And so this would actually align with the West Oakland Emission Reduction Plan. One of the items in that plan was for the Air District to look at their current and future potential for authority under indirect source or magnet source rules. And so the problem, I'll let Brian Bunger explain, you know, sort of the hurdles and the pitfalls that we have on this. But what we're trying to do is come up with a district plan that you know we could feel good about tailoring a bill towards that would allow us to identify magnet sources that have high air toxic health risks. To try to get an inventory of the vehicles going in and out of those areas, and then compel them in some way, or you know get them in some way to make reductions in emissions at those facilities faster than they otherwise would, either through using district incentive programs or state incentive programs or some other method. And so, Brian, if you want to talk a little bit about,
The statute, the enabling statutes we have, California Health and Safety Code, includes a provision that allows us to regulate, in some sense, indirect sources of air pollution. And what that means is not defined, but there's a deep history that goes back into the 1970 Clean Air Act amendments. But fundamentally what it is a source that itself doesn't have air emissions, or at least not interesting amounts of air emissions, but it attracts mobile sources that do. And those could be ships or trucks or cars, could be anything. In the case of the state statute, there's a couple of issues that are explicit and some that are as a result of the sort of statutory history of all of this. The explicit ones are that the authority only extends to controlling pollutants for which the air district is non-attainment. And so in our case, that's a marginal question, but it's ozone and its precursors and PM. Except the state doesn't have the PM standard that we're not attainment of. So we're kind of in a quandary there. So one fix, obviously, is to extend that authority to toxics. And I think that is sort of the most, Alan would know better than I, but that's the one that's probably the least controversial, would be to expand the authority to cover toxics. Then we could sweep in diesel truck emissions, which would be the target that we would primarily aim at, I think. And then on the history side, it's pretty clear from going back through how all this came to be that it's only intended to deal with new sources, which means new magnet operations. So it means that we wouldn't be able to get at the vast majority of the sources we deal with. So there, we've talked about various ways to sort of get that addressed. We can take a run at regulating existing sources, but I think in the end we would have a bit of a struggle with that. But it sounds like a proposal that Alan talked with me a bit about this morning, and I think has been developing with staff, is the idea of getting get the toxics authority, and then get some of these sources to tell us about the traffic that they deal with, the numbers of trucks and that sort of thing. And we can start to figure out some health risk assessment around that, either having them do some of it or us doing that end of the work. But in any event, get some data on this, get started down the path of figuring out some way to either force or cajole or encourage them to access grant funding and that sort of activities, so that we can start to address these truck issues.
If it'll help, Madam Chair. So in the West Oakland plan, that it talks about there's a strategy for us to be able to seek this authority. And why that's in there is because this is all about places like distribution centers. You know, right in the middle of West Oakland is a postal distribution center, and there's just a lot of trucks. And we find ourselves a little frustrated, you know, because we can't force them to take our monies and convert, right? But you could, in theory, see a situation where if we have the right kind of authority, they could be required to both inventory and then be required to file a plan wherein that they would avail themselves of our grant monies to convert them over. I mean, doing everything but requiring, because as Brian will tell you, we're limited in our authorities in terms of mobile source mission standards. So this is the concept.
I'm glad. First, I'm really glad to hear this. I think this is really we've talked about this, a high priority bill to clarify sort of our statutory authority. As you know, the California Air Resources Board came out with a freight plan to reduce emissions from freight, and a key part of that strategy is indirect source rule, the idea that local air districts can have the ability. Would have the ability then to place regulations on warehouses. And I know starting with West Oakland makes a lot of sense, and there, you know, there's other ports as well, and there's other issues, the Port of Richmond, for example. Just hearing the idea to start with toxics, would there be, after looking at that, it seems we'd want to look at criteria pollutants as well, right? But we're focusing now on toxics. I think that makes sense because diesel truck emissions, and also other equipment that may be operating, right, yard equipment and things that may be operating at the port. But you're not asking for authority limited to the Port of Oakland, right? It's just authority within the air district in general.
Well, I think there's some options that we'll have to look through as part of our presentation for this coming November's meeting. But there's a blanket health and safety code citation that talks about indirect source authority that dates back from the mid-1970s. And then there are some air districts that have individual sections of the health and safety code, like South Coast, Bay Area, Mojave Desert, San Joaquin, and some of those districts within their individual sections in the health and safety code have additional indirect source authorities that have been given to them over the years by the legislature. And so one of the questions we'll have to weigh is whether we want to do this as a Bay Area authority within our section of the health and safety code, whether we want to try to do a statewide authority. And get the help of the other air districts to get it through, and then again whether we limit it to 617 communities or care communities, or whether we do it to the region as a whole and allow us to find areas outside of those care communities to focus on as well.
There'll be a balance, because I mean ultimately if you have it applied to all air districts, you bring them on board as allies and they can all advocate for it. Likewise, including all air districts, there could be legislators in some of those districts that oppose it, and so there's potential opposition. So that's the kind of thing you're going to be looking at.
Exactly. And this is all confounded from Prop 26 several years ago that doesn't allow mitigation fees, which have been used in the past by some air districts on indirect sources. And so so we have to figure this out without being able to charge without letting a facility pay a mitigation fee for the district to then get reductions on their behalf.
Right. Thank you.
We do have, I should point out that Alan, when he was APCO of Tehama, didn't you get an indirect source rule passed?
Little Tehama County. one of the few districts that have indirect
sources. Nobody cared. They said, let them do what they want, right? It's Tehama. Do what you want.
It's precedent.
So that's one that we'll bring back in a month to hopefully we'll have a better idea of where we'd like to go on that. So the second item would look to, I guess, try to close a loophole that we discovered with the Stratford School issue, and so we've been thinking about a way that would compel a private school as part of a new construction or modernization to show, I guess, to describe the outside environment a little bit more than what we saw during the Stratford School a lot more. And so the problem is that within the health and safety code, which is what we're most familiar with, there's really only a couple sections that deal with schools, but unfortunately those deal with facilities, with stationary sources that are built or modified that are close to a school, and it requires those sources to send out notifications to the school and to the parents of the children that go to that school, so that the school can participate in that eventual permit decision process. And so one option would be for us to try to modify that health and safety code section and sort of turn it on its head and require a school to do better notification when they're doing something at the school site. But it seems kind of a little bit weird to take a health and safety code section that is trying to solve one issue and then twist it to solve an issue like this. And so that wouldn't be a preferred method. But unfortunately, the most obvious method would be to go into CEQA and make an adjustment to current CEQA rules, which would require more notification. And so in our research, there's actually a section of CEQA within the California Code that talks about requirements that public schools have during site selection and construction. And what public schools have to do in their CEQA documents, either initial study, EIR, mitigated negative declaration is they're required to consult with their local air district. They're required to identify facilities within a quarter mile of that school site and look at the emissions from those facilities. And then as part of their environmental document, they have to make a determination that after looking at the emissions from those facilities that they don't believe that there would be a health impact to the employees at the school or to the students at the school. And so, under CEQA right now, that's limited to public schools and doesn't require that of private schools. And so that would be the, I mean, just looking at it on the face of it, that would seem to be a fix that would be justified. But we are going to have to do some research to find out, you know, why that exemption was originally in there for private schools and to see, you know, whether we're going to be biting off more than we can chew in attempting to make what we think would be a pretty easy fix.
Would if they had checked with the air district, would have that caught this issue? Because I don't, yeah, the neighborhood may never have complained. And
And the parents, the problem that we have now is there aren't any parents. Yeah. I mean, it would have, so that's.
Yeah, based on emissions, probably not. But it is in an industrial area. There's walkability things that public schools have to meet. There's traffic studies that public schools can't, you know, subject their kids to a lot of traffic.
So those would have been part of our comments?
Yeah.
If we'd have been asked.
Yeah, so a public school more than likely wouldn't have been located there because of all those other issues.
Question on that. You know, the superintendent of public instruction lives in Mr. Joya's district, and they're good friends, so I'm going to volunteer him that because both of the charter schools come under that at some point, and maybe Mr. Thurman's staff can help us out, because I've been watching the paper, and maybe I'm not reading correctly, but charter schools are coming under a lot more oversight. And maybe there's a way, you know, maybe we can't get done this second year of the session, but I think all the research you've done is great, but as I was reading and then listening to you, that's the problem. These parents had no idea, and if the school had to meet certain criteria, you know, where are you located, what's around you, what are their issues? So, John, what do you think? Do you think
I'm glad to talk to Tony about it. Let me know more. Let's have an offline discussion, and I'll talk to Tony more.
Especially as it relates to charter schools and putting in there public school or private schools, because anything that's not public, I thought it was interesting they got themselves an exemption. Well, that's all great and fine, but the world has changed. And so, anyway, thank you.
I had a question. So, in their regular project proposal, was there no requirement to do a neg deck, or that this would have come up, or was it just everything was under the?
So
the
my
standards?
Understanding was the there was an original initial study, and then as part of the district would normally get notified through the clearinghouse, but I'm not aware that the district was individually contacted to say, you know, look at this project.
I mean, so rolling forward, we've kind of put in procedures to make sure that we're looking at each one of these, because this, unfortunately, is not the only one of these situations that is now occurring. We've got, in Fremont, it looks like another school that's going to be located next to the Tesla factory.
But it hasn't been built yet?
No, so we are putting in our comments, and we're trying to alert folks. And yeah, there's one in Pittsburgh as well. And what we're saying to these schools is, you know, if this was a public school, here are the things that you would have to consider: proximity to highways,
right,
proximity to train tracks, and more than likely this type of school would not be built. We've also added that information to our own clearinghouses that folks use in their CEQA work, so that we're pointing these things out to people as they try and cite these schools.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I have a quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Damien or Wayne, so what is the tell me a little bit about what the process is now. So what's changed since we dealt with Stratford, and what is currently the policy? How would you handle, how would that situation be handled now? Could you walk me through that?
So, on our site, we have CEQA tools that, that cities and counties use as part of the siting of various things that they want to build. We have guidance on screening levels. And what we've changed on our site is we're saying if you are intending to locate a school in any of these communities, we are recommending that you contact the air district explicitly. So that we can give you the best information, most up-to-date information. We also include the information on that site that, that pertains to the siting of public schools, and we recommend that as a best practice. So that's some of the things that have changed. In our review of the clearinghouse, we are now flagging any projects with schools so we can look to make sure that you know these things are not occurring, and as Wayne said, we've picked up a couple of them, and we have contacted those cities to again express our opinions on the topic. As you all know, local land use authority rests with the cities, and all we can do in this in many of these cases is provide them the best advice that we can provide.
So, you know, we have these parents coming from Stratford, right, and they're sort of, you know, talking to us about, you know, the air district is sort of responsible for this, right? Which is probably, well, it's not probably, but it's unfair. But let me ask you this then. So you communicate with local government, right? And so how do we memorialize that? Is it through a letter? Is it through, how do we go on record on that?
Well, yeah. Director Knuppe, let me, most of our communication, because there are so many actions that go on by 101 cities, and you can just think about all the different actions they take, the best approach we've always taken is through guidelines. And so we have Planning Healthy Places, which is a document we've done. We've also got our CEQA guidelines that a number of board members know the history behind our CEQA guidelines because they've been controversial in the past about siting near freeways and things like that. And so this is one in which we anticipate cities and counties to use those as tools in trying to figure out, you know, the air quality impacts, making sure that whatever the underlying CEQA document is using all those kind of tools that are laid out in our guidelines. I think on this particular one, I think when we look back at the history, I don't know if, frankly, Fremont talked to us on this particular project. I suspect they didn't, I think is what we found out later. When all the uproar occurred, of course, that caused us to sit down, and we've sat down with the city of Fremont now numerous times, and we've held community meetings and things like that. But as Damian mentioned, we've then tried to be proactively trying to look at where are some of these schools being sited. And we've identified a bunch of them already in the pipeline that are going to just duplicate the same scenario that we saw out in Fremont. We're trying to get ahead of it, and there's only so much we can do. So bringing it back to a legislative fix, the thought is, why not have these same type of schools subject to the same type of requirements that public schools need to go through? And hopefully we'll be successful. It's going to be, I think, a tough road here, because I think the school folks, and they haven't got wind of us necessarily thinking that this is an approach we want to take. When they do, I'm sure we'll hear back from them quite a bit.
Well, you know, I appreciate the proactive approach. It's just, you know, when folks come to us on these issues, and I just hope, you know, that regardless if the legislation doesn't, you know, whatever if the legislation doesn't pass, I just hope that folks are aware, and I don't know, it's just through reemphasizing that really we're limited as an agency in the scope that we have over local jurisdiction. And so, you know, hopefully this works, but it, you know, if it doesn't, I think we just have to continue to over communicate that. So I appreciate your time.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, I mean, one of the big issues with this is there's no mandated consultation, and if you could just fix that piece, it would put us in a place where we're affirmatively aware of these sightings, and then we can provide whatever assistance or tools or whatever. I mean, in a lot of these cases, and Stratford may be one, I'm not certain, I don't remember for sure, but in some cases, these things don't end up going through a full CEQA process. They're reusing an existing location or something like that where it's deemed a consistent use, and maybe they don't even require land use decision or a discretionary decision. So requiring consultation, I think, is probably the best way to ensure that at least the air issues will be surfaced and we have an opportunity to
I agree with you. Address. I agree with you on that, Brian, because the issue with Stratford, and remind me, Wayne, was the issue, didn't someone just go to our website and look at the information? So, and from the website, then they made the decision that they made. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. It was the city of Fremont. Their contractors looked at our website, felt that there was no impact, and then placed a school there.
Mm. And part of the problem was, Director Canepa also, was they used an incorrect figure, if I recall. So it just compounded the problem on top of it, because they weren't using necessarily the full throughput number.
And ironically, they moved from they were renting a city of Fremont school site, and they were going to reuse that site. The city of Fremont needed to reopen that school, and so the private school had to move. And it turns out there's a PG&E major gas line under that school, and they can't use it anyway. So either way, they never got the land back.
I did, though, want for all of your sakes to I don't know if you all remember your first reaction when the parents came. Most of you all said the same thing we did, is that how can you not know that this thing was built right next to a set of industrial processes? It's in the middle of an industrial area, by the way. I just wanted to mention that to you because we are struck by the fact that how did they not know that this facility was right next door? That being said, that situation is much more improved, by the way, for all your sakes. That helps you.
All right, I think we can move on.
Okay, so we'll move on. So this one, I believe, was proposed by Director Mitchoff at a previous meeting, and so this is an idea that new schools or modernized schools would be compelled to install HVAC systems that were of a certain MERV level. For wildfire smoke response or for other particulate issues that might be near that school. And so in doing some research on that, so this would, in the end, a bill like that would modify the Title 24 building standards. And so there's two ways that you can do a change to Title 24. So one is you can do a bill that requires that work to be done in an upcoming revision to Title 24. And the other method is to participate in a current Title 24 process and then try to establish your idea and get it put into the upcoming change to the Title 24 program. And so right now they've just finished up the most recent Title 24 updates, and I believe next week they're kicking off the update cycle for the next round of updates, which would be voted on in 2021 and would become required in 2023. And so I think, at least for right now, one what we should do is get involved in that Title 24 update process, at least attend the first couple stakeholder meetings if we can do so, and then do a research of what our options are. What's been done in the past related to mechanical systems and ventilation systems, and then try to figure out if there's a niche that we can propose as part of the future Title 24 update that would make improvements to new or modernized schools going forward, if that would be acceptable to you. Okay. Anytime you can do things without a bill is a good day. and so the last one, this this uh, we've it's not in the write-up, but obviously it's of importance, and it would deal with the power safety shutoff program. And I'll defer to someone else at the table here, but as you know, when PG&E shuts off the power, there's going to be a lot of businesses that are going to start up diesel generators.
I just got an email from and somebody in Monterey who says they did a report. So
there's going to be an increasing usage and purchase of generators. Some may rise to the level of being permitted by the district. Some of them are going to be small enough they aren't going to require permit. And so, but in the end, you know, a power shutoff is probably going to result in extra diesel particulate or other emissions. And so the question is there something that we can do about it going forward to try to at least, even out the air quality impacts during events like this?
Right. I think there's probably some value in having some step being taken either legislatively or otherwise that would at least inventory this, because what our concern is there's just a whole lot of folks, purchasing and securing and putting in place generators, including for the Caldecott Tunnel, by the way, to keep it open. So there clearly is something that we're going to explore here to get on top of it, because while we understand the need, it's going to have air quality impacts. Yeah. And so we want to make sure we have at least have a handle on this. So I think there's going to be more to come on this idea.
Every retail generator has been purchased in the North Bay.
I would imagine.
Well, on the radios, they were talking to Deputy Chief in Cal Fire. A lot of people don't know how to operate them. That's what's scary.
They're going to kill themselves. Yeah.
So you're thinking inventory or caps or?
I wouldn't think that you all, nor would we at all, want to have any kind of restrictions on this, given the extreme situations. That being said, I suspect we'll see a tick up in just PM during this time, even if there isn't any wildfires, just from the PM generated by the generators. So this is just something we want to get a handle on, get a better sense of. And we, along with all the other air districts, are all trying to get in the same place, get a sense of what's going on here on the ground.
So, this happened also back in 2000 during the power problems we had. And so as a result, there was a lot of additional emergency generator use. It was pretty much strictly diesel back then. A couple of years later, once the state had inventoried the impacts due to those shutoffs, the state actually provided incentive funding to air districts to mitigate the impacts that had happened over that time. And so, maybe there's something similar that's possible if we do an inventory and find out that there's a big impact.
Right. We need to get numbers on the ground, get a sense, and that tends to inform us as to what next steps need to be taken. We suspect a lot of this is not permitted, need to be permitted. That's one step, by the way. Not that we're going to go out and write tickets on these things, but I'm just saying that's one step. They either need to be a PERP, portable equipment registration program, or a district permit, one of the two.
Well, and I just wanted to bring up one other thing. I briefly mentioned it, and you've got a very heavy plate, so this could go on another term. This was the issue, and Damien, you may remember, I had an issue in Pleasant Hill where somebody, a company wanted to site electric charging at a Safeway store, and the building codes were prohibitive of it doing it here, but could there. So just and I know you're not the experts on building codes, but at some point have some research done on if that bill or if those codes are better as they are, or if they should change. So, because we're going to be doing more electrification, and we don't want to preclude the ability to site somewhere based on a building code that the benefits are not outweighed by, you know what I mean. It's better to put the electrification than what have you. So this can be a long-term thing, because I'm not expecting it to be introduced on a second year of a two-year given everything else you have to do. But I think it would be important to begin that research. If it's an easy fix, unfortunately I don't think it is, that would be great. But we need to start looking at that to addressing building code situations, because as this money comes in and more people want to electrify, we don't want them to continue to hit whatever this roadblock is. Thank you.
Excuse me, Adam. I'm glad Karen raised that, which prompts the whole issue of, you know, the governor's office of OPR just, you know, issued guidelines about streamlining the permitting for electric vehicle chargers. There's a whole set of guidelines. And there's also a bill that came up that was passed a couple years ago that requires jurisdictions to actually develop some guidelines. And most jurisdictions aren't yet in compliance. They're supposed to have enacted them. So the question is what we could do to strengthen sort of putting these, and maybe it's a bill, you know, as opposed to having the hundreds of jurisdictions in this state, you know, so OPR issues these common guidelines to help the local jurisdictions enact things under a state law, as opposed to maybe a state bill which sets some common standards. And they're all in the governor's OPR guidelines that just got issued in July. Have you seen those? Yeah, you've seen those.
So one of the things that works perhaps even better than legislation is a little bit of peer pressure. So if you remember when we adopted our first regional clean air, regional EV plan, we surveyed cities and counties to see who could issue permits, how long it would take, and we basically put a chart out there. And what happened as part of that was folks learned from each other and that improved. So there's probably another way of us approaching this, which might be, and we're currently in the process of updating our EV plan. It might be time for another survey. And we can, through that survey, highlight who's in compliance and who isn't.
So I mean, Electrify America has said that their number one issue in California has been the lack of consistent permitting standards to build these. That is their number one issue, and they have hundreds of millions of dollars to spend. And so I hear you about peer pressure, but let me just say, the state has entered, you know, has of course passed legislation in some areas, and given the governor's, in fact, the head, the gentleman from GoBiz, can't think of his name, Tyson Eckerly, he showed up at the MCE retreat to remember talk about this issue, and he said the governor's office is going to start identifying they've published a list of jurisdictions mm-hmm. who haven't passed this, you know, their ordinances. Yep. I think there's enough interest in the governor's office here as well, and the legislature to consider. Is there a type of bill that starts to lay the groundwork? You may want to talk to Tyson about this.
We'll take
he may say, well, no, but if he has a bill idea, I think it would help us to actually work and carry, you know, a bill with other air districts, because this is an issue not just in the Bay Area. It will take years to get cities and counties to mm-hmm. sort of do all of this, whereas a state law just makes it happen all at once mm-hmm. to everybody. And if you know, and especially if Electrify America is trying to spend all this money, free money for us, let's make this happen.
Well, and I want to tag on to John tagging on to me. I'm working with the city, and you know, I've got airport resources and staffs, and you know all this, but they've got they're very parochial, and I'm working with them on something else, and they just feel like they know what they're doing, and this is what it is. So John's right. We need, it would be great, but mm-hmm. peer pressure isn't going to do it, because they're going to say, well, this is what the building code says, and we don't have time to play around with it.
Yeah, they're so busy, a lot of them, doing so many things.
We need to make it, this is what you have to do, and this is, I don't even care if we tell them why they got to do it, just that, again, and I'm glad to know the governor wants to streamline it, because it's just horrible when you're dealing with a big company like and a settlement where we got this money and then they run into roadblocks. So I can't get it in one city, but I can get it in another. I want it all over. So enough said.
So I'll recommend. I'll remind you that when we did that plan back in 2013, our number one recommendation in that plan was cities and counties not concentrate on deploying EVSE, but concentrate on the permitting process.
Right,
so
it hasn't happened.
Hasn't happened.
State bill.
And stuff
will make it happen.
We didn't have the
state bill. Will make
that should be easy.
Identify. I'm sure OPR would be excited about this.
We can take that back. We've got a good relationship with Tyson, so we can talk to him.
Are there any other comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just had a couple of questions since that's the list that was presented. Is there a plan to secure funding to implement 836?
So there's a couple. So I talked a little bit about trying to get in the governor's initial budget in January, talking with our legislative, with our Senate and Assembly members about getting funding for that bill. There's the federal aspect of it with Senator Merkley's bill that we're trying to get California support for, and then also the bond measures. And so to answer your question, you know, we don't have anything identified yet for funding going forward, but we have some areas that we're working on to try to make it happen.
So is it fair to ask that be part of the strategy for this year legislatively? Because it doesn't really feel like a win when you just get a bill that says only if you do other things. So I just want to check. I didn't hear anyone present how we're going to do that.
No, Director Bowers, I think it's a great point. I think so our meeting in November, I think we're going to have a Legislative Committee meeting in November when we're going to. So, and we should have probably started this in this discussion. This is the meeting where we try to say, here are all the ideas for next year. Mm-hmm. Get your feedback. And then if there is, if this is your direction, we'll go back, put flesh on the bone, and come back to you. And this is one in which we will have ready for you at your next meeting where we can lay out a plan.
Okay. So that was my first item. Thank you for that. And my other item is just as a question, because I'm sure this has been raised, maybe it hasn't here before, but and it wouldn't be easy, so I'm just putting it out as an idea, but we do spare the air days, and I don't understand the point of them, and it's mostly because I don't see anyone changing their behavior, and so I'm wondering what we can do to make a spare the air day actually something that people have to make different choices about, and you know, ideas that I just have, and I don't know how feasible they are, right? But I just want to put out there. I mean, why aren't we working on whether it should be it may have to be a ballot measure, it may be legislation, but why aren't we saying that the tolls are higher on spare the air days? Why aren't we saying that money raised from those higher tolls is used to subsidize public transportation? There seems to me to be a financial nexus between the decisions people make related to transportation and their pocketbook, and it feels like right now it's just a sign on the Yerba Buena Island. For those of us who bike to the island, it's you know, it comes out on the little social media feeds, but you don't see anyone change it. So it just feels to me like we expend a lot of time and effort on a program that doesn't do anything, and except remind people that we're in a climate crisis, perhaps. And I just feel like we should probably explore incentivization for making alternative choices. And I think there should be partnership with transit agencies to discuss ways to monetize the decision to pollute and not spare the air. And that's not going to be easy because toll authorities and the entire car culture is going to say, over my dead body, another toll. But even if we're adding a dollar on every person who uses the bridges, we're talking a lot of money on a spare mm-hmm. of the air day. And if that goes to subsidize transit systems mm-hmm. so that transit systems can make the investments necessary to improve themselves, I think we should be doing that. That's my suggestion.
So we will remember where this idea comes from.
Yeah.
The Bowers toll? No, I'm kidding. No. Let us take that back because I think it's a good
I just wanted the Spare the Air program has evolved over time. So there are times when we did do incentives for riding BART. We tried to change behaviors long term various times during the whole campaign. So this is another point in time where we can change the program and try and do something different. So I like the idea.
I like it. Anyone else? Any comments? any public comments? No? All right. Then we will move on to item 7, public comments on non-agenda matters. Any cards? No. Moving on to item 8, committee members' comments, other business. Any comments from directors? No? All right. Then we move on to item 9, time and place of next meeting. It says Monday, November 4th. I have a standing... I know I've had issues with it. I have a standing conflict on Mondays, so I'm hoping we can look at other dates, if that's okay with the rest of the committee.
Well, and that's why I was talking to John. He and I have a standing committee date. I was just giving directions that we could move it, but if others have a problem. And I know November's not an easy time to get a meeting.
Right.
So I agree. You know, and November 4th is really only 3 weeks away, and that's you've got a lot on your plate. So I don't know if you want to try and find another date in early December. Or...
Okay.
Can I ask a question,
sure.
Madam Chair, as
yes.
to how does the committee feel about having back-to-back committee meetings, meaning where you would have two different committees meet
sure.
on the same day?
That's
are you all okay with that?
I'm
because
sure
I do
that.
Get
we
that.
Do that
feel...
all the time in the
yeah.
I know, but you have some board members who have really have objected to that idea.
That would be the best thing you could possibly
yes.
do.
Okay.
Like at
driver.
Alameda Transportation, we literally have all six committees in
mm-hmm.
a row.
Okay.
And we just, it's like, I know I have one day a month. It's
yes.
like, to get and once you get everybody on the one day a month where all the committees
mm-hmm.
are heard, they figure it out. Like,
okay.
yeah.
It just saves.
It's just because you guys constantly emailing to schedule and then we don't have a quorum. And it's like, because I know that this was originally, one of them, Stationary Source, was scheduled for the 18th of November. And I'm going to be in another country. And so then they tell me, well, we don't have quorum now without you. So now can you do December? And we're just constantly playing schedule jumping games.
Right.
And if we just
right.
picked one day a month and had all the committees in a row, it'd be easier.
So are we not we're looking at another date besides, then I won't
cancel your thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
We'll look at for another date for November 4th, other than November 4th. But I just wanted to, this is good feedback for us. So we might
we
put it on a day in which there's other committee meetings.
Can we do it? Can we do that, Madam Chair? Can we do that now? Can we just talk about what days work? Because it feels like we're here. And rather than, like, guessing around, I don't know. I mean, I'm going to freak Vanessa out probably.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Oh,
and I
guess not everyone is here.
If you guys don't
mind
me speaking,
yes.
You can send me the email with the dates, but also it has to do with room availability.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because we're not,
yes. we're not going to be able to do all
yeah.
committee meetings.
Could
but
you send us a doodle?
Yeah, she'll do
survey
that.
And that'll.
Yep. So the day I was thinking about was November 6th, actually. That's actually the day in which I believe it's a November, I think it's an executive committee meeting.
Oh, so no board meeting.
It's not going to be
oh.
a board
yeah,
meeting.
We may not have
fine.
Multiple, but yeah, I mean,
I'm
not an executive, but I can come and whatever. So.
Because you would have had that day for
yes,
the full
for the board
meeting.
Mm-hmm.
You
yeah.
want
right
us
now
to
it's
just
look
exactly. at that date now yeah. instead?
So I'm just trying
the
to,
six, I can do this.
Doctor,
this.
Director
it
Bowers.
It sounds like the six.
You know, the schedule, it gets really complicated, right? Because
Vanessa knows how to deal with this.
Yeah.
yeah.
Okay. I hate this when we do this.
I would just mention the Budget and Finance Committee also has a meeting now on the 25th, which is the Monday of the Thanksgiving week. And so in terms of weeks where people probably don't have lots of other meetings scheduled, but maybe everyone can come in on a Monday
yeah,
to do
I'd
it.
I'd be happy to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, so stay tuned for an email.
Sure.
And so now we stand adjourned.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Are they looking at closing down
not
your area at noon or?
Part of Pleasant Hill, and but not so much Concord, Walnut Creek. So I'm looking for updates. But
mine
my thing is once they've sort of put it in motion, they're not going to. And
no,
they
don't.
The traffic I heard.
We haven't. I haven't seen a speck of wind.